Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 113. I'm recording this episode a bit early, so I will not be doing the local COVID-19 update for the first time in over a year. Plus, I am foregoing COVID-19 stories this week in an official reopening of sorts for the show. May COVID-19 recede quickly into the past. Though I am guessing that there will be plenty of COVID-19 news and research in the coming year. But today I'm going to report on a series of environmental health justice stories, plus a block of stories on how for-profit sick care does not produce health well, and what some solutions that public health has to offer. First up, from the New York Times, Florida crisis highlights a nationwide risk from toxic ponds. They are ponds the size of city blocks, wastewater pits that hold the hazardous byproducts of coal, lagoons brimming with diluted pig excrement, vast pools atop stacks of radioactive tailings. The risk posed by pools of waste like these, a common feature at thousands of industrial and agricultural sites across the country, have been brought into sharp relief by a giant wastewater pond in Piney Point, Florida, that in recent weeks had appeared in danger of catastrophic failure. Officials said the threat of collapse had passed and residents were allowed to return home after an emergency effort had pumped millions of gallons of water out of the pond and into local waterways. The environmental effects of such a large release of contaminated water remains unknown. Though recently, the specter of a deluge had prompted the authorities to evacuate hundreds of people from their homes. Open-air ponds are vital to major industries, like livestock and power generation, but environmental groups say they pose major environmental health and safety risks, whether from mismanagement or, increasingly, from the effects of climate change. They're just an irresponsible way to store very dangerous waste, said Daniel Estrin, general counsel at the Waterkeeper Alliance, a clean water nonprofit group. And with climate change, we're going to see more frequent and stronger storms that are going to impact these sites. The Florida emergency at a former phosphate mining plant south of Tampa is particularly dire. There, a pool that initially held more than 400 million gallons of wastewater, with traces of heavy metals and other toxic substances, sits atop a pile of phosphogypsum tailings at least 70 feet tall. Tailings are waste that is left behind when ores from phosphate mining are processed to create phosphoric acid, an ingredient used in fertilizers. For decades, the tailings, a radioactive wet slurry containing traces of radium, along with arsenic, lead, and other elements, were placed in ponds and left to evaporate, leaving behind enormous stacks of phosphogypsum topped by water. The fear was that if the pond collapsed, it could wash away the tailings, sending a wall of water over nearby homes and businesses. The mounds of tailings like these, which are scattered across more than 24 sites across Florida, are some of the tallest earthen structures in the state. Florida is the world's largest phosphate-producing area, according to the EPA, and accounts for about 80% of the nation's phosphate mining. The United States mines and consumes about 23 million tons of phosphate a year. But at the site of the current breach, evaporation is not kept up with rainfall, which continued to add to the site's ponds. On numerous occasions over the past year, the site's owner, HRK Holdings, found tears in a plastic liner that holds wastewater and warned local officials that the ponds were fast running out of capacity. Reached by phone, Jeff Barath, the general manager at HRK Holdings, said he was, quote, just the boots on the ground guy and was not authorized to speak to the press. The number he gave for a spokesman, as well as a number listed on the company's corporate website, failed to connect. To relieve pressure on the pool's walls, workers had been releasing about 35 million gallons of wastewater a day into nearby waterways. Even though a fear of a wider breach appears to have passed, there's likely to be environmental fallout from the emergency release of the polluted water, which also contains nutrients that could spur harmful algae blooms, followed by fish kills. When the highest point on our horizon is a toxic waste site, it's terrifying, said Hannah Connor, a senior attorney for the Environmental Health Program at the Center for Biological Diversity. And with more rain events and more severe storms, this is going to happen more frequently. While phosphogypsum tailing stacks like the one at the Piney Point site are concentrated in Florida, thousands of industrial and agricultural open-air wastewater ponds dot the country. They include at least 70 phosphogypsum stacks, 700 coal ash ponds near coal-burning power plants, and thousands of agricultural facilities like the vast lagoons at large industrial livestock farms. Those agricultural pools generally have a striking bubblegum pink hue, a deceptively cheerful color that results from anaerobic bacteria that digest the fetid slurry, a mixture of water, animal excrement, and chemicals. When farming was done on a more human scale, manure had value to farmers as fertilizer for corn, which would then feed the next generation of pigs and cows. But now, the bulk of corn is grown at an industrial scale using synthetic fertilizers. As a result, excrement today is collected and stored in these cesspits. These earthen pits, many of which are unlined, pose a risk of leaching into the groundwater, said DeAnne Williams, a researcher for the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Gases also come off the lagoons, or crust can form on top, trapping the gas and then releasing bursts of hydrogen sulfide or ammonia, both affecting air quality in the area. And when you have flooding and you can't manage the amount of water that's coming in, you can end up with the bacteria and chemicals in the surface water and on the land. Hurricane Florence, which brought record-breaking flooding to the Carolinas in 2018, swamped more than 100 hog lagoons, unleashing their contents into the floodwater. Excess nitrates in pig manure have also been linked with health problems, like blue baby syndrome, which causes the blood to become unable to carry oxygen around an infant's body and can be fatal. Various efforts to strengthen federal oversight of manure lagoons have faltered, and most ponds are regulated at the state level. However, the Environmental Protection Agency has acted in some of the most egregious cases, ordering dairy farms to shore up their lagoons after tests showed elevated nitrate levels, which can harm human health in residential drinking water wells. In the early 2000s, the agricultural giant Smithfield Foods promised to study alternative ways to handle manure under an agreement with North Carolina. An expert appointed by the world's largest pork producer, now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese meat and food processing company WH Group, came up with a number of different options, including one that would solidify the fecal waste, but none of these were found to be economically feasible. Environmental groups recently petitioned the state to revisit the agreement. Smithfield has said it has already fully complied with the agreement's terms. The company did not immediately provide further comment. It's a model that needs to be revised. This large-scale animal production model, Ms. Williams said. These are huge industries, but they're not regulated as industries. They're still regulated as if they're small farms. Hundreds of coal ash ponds. When a coal-fired power station generates electricity, they leave behind hundreds of thousands of tons of toxic residue called coal ash, which is mixed with water and sluiced into ponds on the plant property. Kent Burdett, the Cape Fear riverkeeper in North Carolina, has seen what happens when those ponds of the ash, which contain arsenic, mercury, lead, and other heavy metals hazardous to human health, are overrun by floods. Hurricane Florence inundated Duke Energy's Sutton plant in Wilmington, North Carolina, which had previously burned coal. Today it burns gas. In response to a lawsuit filed by environmental groups, Duke had started to excavate the ponds, moving the coal ash into lined landfills, but floodwaters eroded the site's defenses, releasing coal ash. "You had this torrent of water that had picked up the coal ash just pouring out," Mr. Burdett said. "You could see big spirals of the ash just floating down the river." Bill Norton, a Duke spokesman, said that, quote, "a very small amount of ash had made its way off plant property and was recovered." More than 700 landfills and bodies of water across the United States still store coal ash. An Obama-era rule would have required power companies to start closing their coal ash ponds in 2018, but the Trump administration, in one of its many rollbacks of environmental regulations, moved to weaken the rule. President Biden is now reviewing the rollback. North Carolina, though, has started to require power companies to excavate their coal ash storage ponds under a new state law that requires all ponds closed by 2029. The ash secured, dried out, and moved away from the water. The Sutton plant's ponds are now closed. The claim was always, "We can't clean this stuff up. It's impossible," Mr. Burdett said. But of course it's possible. You just have to spend the money to do it. Okay, next up, from Grist. America's biggest jails are frontline environmental justice communities. For more than half a century, 441 Boschet Street has been the address where Los Angeles' most stark social and environmental inequalities converge. It's the location of LA's Men's Central Jail, the largest facility in the most populated county jail system in the country. On any given day, about 5,000 people are incarcerated there. A block south from the jail is the 101 freeway, one of the most traveled highways in America, which generates dangerous levels of air pollution linked to a slew of birth defects. A block east is the LA River, home to at least 20 different pollutants from feces to oil at levels that violate federal standards. Another 100 yards east is the SP Rail Yard and Union Pacific Transportation Center, which operates at all hours, receiving big rig diesel trucks that spew an estimated 40 tons of particulate matter into the air annually. According to data compiled by the EPA, by the Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Justice Screening Tool, those detained inside Men's Central Jail are situated closer to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste than 96% of the country. Their lifetime cancer risk from the inhalation of air toxics is the 100th percentile, meaning there is virtually no place in the country where it's higher. Men's Central's proximity to extreme toxicity isn't an anomaly. A Grist analysis of the 11 jails in the three biggest county jail systems in America, Los Angeles, New York City, and Chicago, found that people residing within or surrounding eight of these facilities are in the 90th percentile or higher for pollution-related cancer risk, respiratory hazards, and diesel pollution exposure. Nine of the facilities are located closer to toxic wastewater than at least 97% of the country, and all 11 are in the 90th percentile or higher for proximity to hazardous waste. None of this is accidental. New York City's biggest jail, Rikers Island, was built on a former landfill. Now its inmates reside in closer proximity to hazardous waste than 97% of Americans. Chicago's Cook County Jail, located in the middle of Little Village, one of the most polluted communities in America, is home to more diesel pollution than virtually anywhere else in the country. While formal research on toxicity in prisons has typically focused on more permanent detention facilities, such as state prisons, little has been done around jails because they're seen as temporary holding facilities for people awaiting trial. But data show that it's common for some people, and particularly poor people, to spend months and sometimes years in county jail before ever being convicted of a crime. Cash bail requirements mean that people who can't afford to put up enough money to be released on bail are often effectively serving a sentence while nominally awaiting trial. For this reason, jails can be an emerging focus of the environmental justice movement. This is because environmental justice advocates focus on so-called frontline communities, places that shoulder a disproportionate burden of a society's waste, contamination, and pollution. Louisiana's Cancer Alley, for example, hosts many of the nation's petrochemical plants, and its majority black residents see the effects show up in their health. David Pello, director of the Global Environmental Justice Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara, argues that those incarcerated in county jails constitute a frontline community equally worthy of the movement's attention. But historically, Pello says, Those cycling through the detention system have been ignored in the environmental justice movement because they've been, quote, viewed as populations who just do not matter. Their fate is linked to ours, from the water systems that we are all drinking, to the air that we all breathe, to the land that we all live on. A jail wall is nothing but a wall, not much more. Indeed, patterns of incarceration lay bare the relationship between race, poverty, and pollution. We know that a history of discriminatory housing policies, like redlining, forced people of color to undesirable and often toxic parts of cities. Today, those same communities are more likely to be over-policed and in poverty, making people of color more vulnerable to pollution and criminalization. This social and environmental harm is then intensified when members of these communities are moved out of the toxic environments in which they live and into toxic facilities where they are held against their will. Black and brown and poor white folks in prisons and jails are clearly coming from communities where they are at greater risk for these social and environmental threats, Pello said. Then they are being siphoned off, extracted, taken hostage by the state, and locked up in cages in the belly of this beast. Some research suggests that mass incarceration creates environmental harms that reach well beyond these marginalized communities. A 2020 study on how mass incarceration contributes to climate change found that increasing state-level incarceration rates between 1997 and 2016 were correlated with increases in industrial emissions and the use of toxic chemicals because of the expansion of industrial prison supply manufacturing operations. At the local level, some organizers in California have had success combining anti-detention and environmental justice organizing. Golden State organizers were able to block the construction of two jails in San Francisco in 2016 by framing the facilities as toxic burdens on the surrounding communities. In 2019, the Los Angeles-based Youth Justice Coalition and other community groups were able to stop a new jail after claiming the new building would worsen the community's air pollution and potentially contaminate the surrounding soil and nearby water sources by disturbing two underground chemical storage tanks. Through its All Jails Are Toxic campaign, the group argues that jails worsen things like traffic pollution and the degradation of natural resources, leading to greater environmental racism in local communities, according to Youth Justice Coalition's Emilio Zapien. The coalition contends that the money dedicated to incarceration could better be spent on measures to disrupt the need for jails, such as education, food, and job programs. With the focus on sites of incarceration as points of environmental harm, Pello hopes the environmental justice movement will be redefined to emphasize a collective need for transformative interventions for the most marginalized. Focusing on these carceral spaces allows us to expand the realm of how we define not only environmental justice concerns, but also environmental justice activism and leadership. Okay, well, this next story scares the bejeebers out of me, both as a legacy issue spanning generations that continues to this very day. This from CBS News. How a shocking environmental disaster was uncovered off the California coast after 70 years. Just 10 miles off the coast of Los Angeles lurks an environmental disaster over 70 years in the making, which few have ever heard about. That is until now, thanks to the research of a University of California marine scientist named David Valentine. Working with little more than rumors and a hunch, curiosity guided him to 3,000 feet below the ocean's surface. A few hours of research time in an autonomous robotic submersible unearthed what had been hidden since the 1940s. Countless barrels of toxic waste, laced with DDT, littering the ocean floor in between Long Beach and Catalina Island. The fact that his underwater camera spotted dozens of decaying barrels immediately in what is otherwise a barren desert-like seafloor, Valentine says, is evidence that the number of barrels is likely immense. Although the exact number is still unknown, a historical account estimates it may be as many as 500,000 barrels. After 70-plus years of inaction, Valentine's research has helped initiate a huge research effort to reveal the extent of the contamination. But this offshore dump site is only part of the story of environmental damage from years of DDT discharge along the coast of Southern California. A story which likely won't be closed for decades to come because of its ongoing impact, including a recently discovered alarming and unprecedented rate of cancer in the state's sea lion population, with one in every four adult sea lions plagued with the disease. The history of DDT dumping. The chemical DDT was invented in 1939 and used during World War II as a pesticide, helping to protect troops from insect-borne diseases like malaria. After the war, production of the chemical ramped up, and it became routinely used in the spraying of crops and even overcrowded beaches to eliminate pests like mosquitoes. But in the 1960s, DDT was discovered to be toxic. Over time, eating food laced with DDT builds up inside the tissues of animals and humans, resulting in harmful side effects. The EPA now calls it, quote, a probable human carcinogen. That's an understatement. In 1972, when the U.S. government started taking environmental pollution seriously with legislation like the Clean Air Act, DDT was banned in the United States. The largest DDT manufacturer in the U.S., Montrose Chemical Corporation, was located along the Southern California coast in the city of Torrance. From 1947 through 1982, Montrose manufactured and distributed DDT worldwide. In doing so, a byproduct mix of toxic sludge made up of petrochemicals, DDT, and PCBs was produced. For decades, that hazardous waste was disposed of in two ways. Some of the toxic pollution was dumped into storm drains and the sewer system, which was then pumped out to sea through outflow pipes 2 miles offshore of the city of Rancho Palos Verdes. The rest of the waste was disposed of in barrels, which were loaded onto barges and floated 10 to 15 miles offshore to waste dumping sites off Catalina Island and then jettisoned into the ocean. While it may seem hard to believe, at least part of the dumping was legally permitted. Back then, Valentine says, the prevailing thought was that the oceans were so huge that they could never be compromised. Their mantra was, dilution is the solution to pollution. In hindsight, a naive notion. But while the designated dumping site was very deep, in 3,000 feet of water, Valentine says shortcuts were taken, with barrels being dumped much closer to shore. And in an effort to get the barrels to sink, there is evidence that many were slashed, allowing poison to leak as they were dropped into the ocean. For decades, the existence of these toxic barrels was surmised only by a very small group of scientists and regulators. That's despite a startling report produced in the 1980s by a California Regional Water Quality Control Board scientist named Alan Chartrand, which asserted there may be as many as 500,000 barrels laced with DDT sitting on the ocean floor. The report was largely ignored, but after nearly 30 years, Valentine dusted it off as he began his quest to see if these barrels existed. Despite the fact that the toxic barrels were dumped in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, their existence just became common knowledge this past fall when the Los Angeles Times published a feature on Valentine's work. But his discovery dates all the way back to 2011, when he first decided to see if the rumors of the barrels were true. In 2013, he made another trip to the site, but his research was not published until March of 2019. In all, his time-limited work yielded visuals of 60 barrels. Besides bringing back video of the leaking barrels, his team was also able to collect samples from the ocean floor. One of them registered a contamination 40 times greater than the highest contamination at the Superfund site, indicating that the toxins down deep are still very concentrated. Armed with this compelling evidence, Valentine said that he beat the drum for years, speaking to various government agencies, trying to get some interest, but to no avail. However, when the LA Times story came out, interest finally followed as public outcry grew. As of our last conversation with Eric Terrell, the team leader, the final number had still not been tallied, but even as early as a week into the research mission, Terrell described detecting tens of thousands of targets and said the numbers of barrels seems overwhelming. Located right near the Golden Gate Bridge, the mission of the Marine Mammal Center of Sausalito, California, is to rescue marine animals in distress. Since 1975, the organization says they have rescued 24,000. In December, the team published a 30-year study on sea lions, finding an alarming statistic. 25% of adult sea lions have cancer. CBS News interviewed the lead veterinarian, Dr. Kara Field. She called the number of sea lions with cancer both extremely alarming and unprecedented in wildlife. While there are still many unanswered questions, one lesson from the story of DDT contamination is clear. When humans callously pollute the environment, it can have consequences for generations to come. One current example is human-caused climate change. The question is, how much of a burden will our children and grandchildren have to bear as a result of our choices?
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment, from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones, from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see, try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well now we're going to switch gears from environmental health justice to a series of stories about for-profit healthcare, or sick care, probably more appropriately termed, and how that doesn't work well to produce wellness in our country. And then we will a little bit later get at some potential solutions to some of these problems. First up, from Stat News, for-profit nursing homes and hospices are a bad deal for older Americans. Nursing homes and hospice care are supposed to provide safe refuges for older people and those near the ends of their lives. During the COVID-19 pandemic, they have been just the opposite. Many nursing homes and hospice care organizations are now for-profit institutions. There is ample evidence that they are putting profits ahead of people, and that is taking a deadly toll during the pandemic. Nursing home residents account for 1% of the United States population, but make up over 35% of COVID-19 deaths. Even in this incredibly high-risk group, residing in a for-profit nursing home further increased the risk of COVID-19 infection or death. To date, 6 studies have evaluated the impact of nursing home ownership status on COVID-19. All 6 showed that the risk of infection or death from COVID-19 was significantly higher in for-profit nursing homes. The staffs at for-profit nursing homes don't fare much better. Not only do nurses in for-profits have to take care of more patients, they also have less access to personal protective equipment. Private equity investment fundamentally changes nursing homes. It increases deaths by 10% among nursing home residents, while quality of care, as evidenced by staffing and other measures, drops even as costs rise for both Medicare and patients. Conversely, when ownership changes from for-profit to non-profit, care quality improves. This is also a matter of racial justice, since for-profit nursing homes and hospices are more likely to care for Black and Hispanic patients. Far from scrutiny, many state legislatures are being successfully pressed by lobbyists to shield nursing homes from lawsuits. Even if they deliver poorer care, many for-profit nursing homes receive millions in government funds to shore them up. Many private equity investors are now indulging in dubious business practices, such as buying nursing homes, then renting the building back to the nursing home operator and charging excess management fees. Private equity has also successfully infiltrated hospice care. Hospice is a service provided mostly in people's homes by nurses and social workers for individuals expected to live for 6 months or less. Born out of a movement to provide humane care to people and their caregivers at the end of life, 2/3 of hospice agencies in the U.S. are now for-profit companies. Research that several colleagues and I published last year shows that even at the cost of hospice care is increasing, the quality of care is plummeting. This has to do with patients receiving care in for-profit hospices, which provide poorer staffing, fewer community benefits, and enroll patients who stay in hospice longer and therefore accrue more revenue, while requiring less intensive care, such as that needed for people with dementia. There's increasing convergence between for-profit nursing homes and hospice, as more than 20% of nursing homes and hospices now have common ownership, often as part of a chain. As the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed, age is far more than a number, and older individuals are among the most vulnerable members of society. Many are alone with few friends or family members to watch out and advocate for them. When I care for patients in the hospital, even my most diligent work can mean nothing if they receive poor care at the nursing facility to which they are discharged. Nursing homes and hospices have not been traditionally scrutinized like hospitals or other entities in healthcare. That must change. The evidence suggests that tens of thousands of individuals, many of them people of color, died during the COVID-19 pandemic simply because they happened to be in facilities that prized profits. Instead of shielding them from scrutiny, lawmakers should do more to ensure that facilities entrusted with caring for older adults are operating at a high level. In a new report, the New York Attorney General recommended eliminating immunity provisions for nursing homes so accountability is not waived. That would increase transparency in the business practices for for-profit facilities. And while the U.S. Justice Department has caught many for-profit nursing homes and hospices engaging in fraud, a more systemic effort is needed. The Biden administration and Congress should prioritize studying for-profit business practices in elder care. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has devised a grading system to rank how well nursing homes perform. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that those with higher rankings, primarily due to better nursing staff, had fewer COVID-19 cases. For-profit nursing homes are twice as likely to have poor rankings than nonprofits, making the case that these rankings should be linked to reimbursements that nursing homes receive. The mark of a strong and ethical country is how it cares for its elders. There has never been a more important time to stand up for them and oppose for-profit corporate interests whose sole interest appears to be enriching themselves instead of helping older people and those nearing the ends of their lives. You're listening to Just for the Health of It, the weekly public health program on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Next up, from Stat News, medical device firm payments to doctors far outstrip those from pharma, study shows. The medical device industry gave doctors consulting fees, lunches, lodging, and other incentive payments worth $904 million between 2014 and 2017, per a new study. More than $80 million more than the pharmaceutical industry lavished on physicians over the same time period. Experts told Stat that the findings, published in Health Affairs, raise new questions about the industry's influence on physician behavior, particularly since the medical device industry pulls in far less revenue than the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors must report any payments they receive from medical device makers, pharmaceutical companies, and other businesses in a government database called Open Payments that aims to help patients, researchers, and journalists understand the financial relationships that might be influencing a physician's opinion. But until now, virtually all of the attention and scrutiny of the payments, as well as research into the links between payments and physician behavior, has focused on pharma. While a tight-knit relationship between medical device firms and physicians is often necessary for training and product development, the large scale of payments may inhibit the public's trust between the patient and their provider, the research and other experts said. If the relationship between the patient and the physician is contaminated by perverse financial incentives, then it does erode the public trust, which is a sacred value in our heritage, our great medical heritage, said Marty Makary, professor of surgery and health policy at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, who was not involved in the research. Medical device firm representatives often work side by side with physicians in the operating room, educating them on how to use their product and receiving feedback for developmental purposes. Helping a doctor learn how to use a pacemaker or an insulin pump is very different from explaining the dosages of a new pill. The intimate relationship has sparked the development of breakthrough medical products, but medical device representatives often use the increased face time with physicians as an opportunity to pitch their products, according to the study and industry experts. Both Alan Bergman, co-author of the study and postdoctoral researcher at the Leonard Davis Institute for Health Economics and the Wharton School, and Aaron Mitchell, an oncologist and health services researcher at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Research Center, worried that the influence of a salesperson in the operating room creates blurred lines when doctors are deciding which product is best. "I find that problematic," said Mitchell, who was not involved in the research. "It becomes a lot harder to decide which product is best when that salesperson is also taking you out to $500 dinners and pays you tens of thousands of dollars in consulting fees over the last few years." The researchers found that the device industry lavished the most money in its payments to surgical specialists. Surgical specialists receive 7 times more money from device firms than drug vendors. These doctors, the paper noted, are far more likely to implant or otherwise use medical devices in their work. "The companies know where their bread is buttered," Mitchell said. The researchers relied on an algorithm to help label the open payments data, since many of the entries did not specify whether a physician had been paid by a drug or device maker. The study was limited to open payments data and didn't look at whether payments had had any effect on prescribing or product use. And that's where Bergman said the field needs to go next. He suggested further research could examine how financial incentives from medical device firms impact physician behavior. He and his co-authors also said that increased data transparency, like requiring unique medical device identifiers in medical claims, is critical for future studies. Almost nobody talks about medical devices, Bergman said. I would just note that in other areas of physician influence by, say, pharmaceutical representatives, it's definitely been shown that these payments, incentives, and benefits definitely influence physician behavior. Okay, well, one of the problems with our fractured sick care system is you have to figure out who gets paid for what in a very competitive, cutthroat way. This researcher here from Medical Express talks about looking at social factors in order to guide this to more accurately link quality with payment. Making a case for adjusting quality measures for social risk factors. A new analysis by a team of researchers led by Dr. David Nerens of Henry Ford Health System suggests that accounting for social risk factors like poverty, housing instability, and transportation insecurity can have meaningful impact on healthcare quality measures without compromising quality of care. In our analysis, we show that adjusting for social risk factors will not necessarily mask or excuse poor quality. Instead, it can demonstrate exceptional levels of quality among safety net providers. Adjusting quality measures for social risk factors has been the focus of ongoing debate for the last decade since the Medicare Hospital Readmission Reduction Program has shown to disproportionately penalize safety net hospitals financially. Safety net hospitals have long held they are unfairly penalized because social risk factors put their patients at higher risk for readmission and are not adjusted for in this program. Dr. Nerens and Dr. Maddox led a study published in Health Services Research in 2019 that found a risk adjustment model, including social factors, could reduce the financial penalty for at least half of all safety net hospitals, which care for patients regardless of their insurance status or ability to pay. In some cases, the study says, the adjustment model could render them free from any penalty. Conversely, more affluent hospitals, those that care for higher income, better educated patients, could see their penalty for readmission rates increase. Quality measures like mortality rates, readmission rates, complication rates, and average functional improvement are used to compare doctors, hospitals, home health agencies, and health plans. These measures are then applied to determine financial rewards and penalties for providers that perform relatively well or relatively poor. Because providers don't treat the same mix of patients, and some patients are at higher or lower risk of poor outcomes than others, some form of statistical adjustment is needed to apply to level the playing field to make comparisons, Dr. Nerens said. While clinical risk factors like age, presence of other illness, and severity of illnesses are used routinely in these adjustments, social risk factors are not. At issue is whether the financial penalties reflect true differences in quality of care, or they reflect factors other than quality that are outside of the provider's control. So this is basically getting at a way to adjust so that you don't have the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer in healthcare, and that you actually punish providers for caring for the sickest patients. Okay, well, next story gets at pre-authorization or prior authorization as a supposed cornerstone for preventing fraud and waste and unnecessary medical expenses. So this from Stat News. Instead of prior authorization, insurers should go back to the old pay-and-chase model. Rather than being the exception, denials and delays by insurance companies are often the norm. The American Medical Association has been surveying doctors about prior authorization reviews for several years. Their impact is not good. 83% of doctors report that prior authorization requirements harm the continuity of care, and 86% report that the problem has gotten worse over the last 5 years. The rationale for insurers requiring prior authorization and engaging in utilization reviews seems legitimate, at least at first glance, because there is waste and fraud in the healthcare system. With some $3.8 trillion, almost 18% of the nation's gross domestic product being spent on healthcare each year, the temptation for wrongdoers is substantial. Insurance industry and law enforcement estimates of healthcare fraud range between 3% and 10% of that $3.5 trillion. At the high end, that's about $350 billion annually. The administrative cost of rooting out this waste and fraud is even higher than the fraud itself. The Center for American Progress estimates that billing and insurance-related costs to be $496 billion annually. And the National Academy of Medicine estimates that these costs are twice as high as they need to be. Doctors estimate that they and staff members spend 2 full business days a week dealing with prior authorization bureaucracy. For insurers, the administrative hoops they demand doctors jump through make perfect sense, at least economically. Doctors report that 20% of patients always or often abandon the treatment their doctors have recommended while awaiting authorization, and another 55% sometimes do. When patients don't get the prescribed test or treatment, that saves the insurer money. Tellingly, insurance companies have provided scant evidence that their utilization reviews and demands for prior authorization have actually helped root out waste or fraud. The industry's trade group, brilliantly named the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association, does a capable job of recounting the hypothetical estimates of fraud and citing appalling stories of crooked providers illegally reaping millions from scams. Insurers' rationale for prioritization is simple. It bolsters the bottom line. Tellingly, it is a reversal of their longtime practice of pay and chase. Once upon a time, insurers would pay medical claims up front and then use their investigators to attempt to recover payments believed made in error or as a result of fraud. By shifting the burden to doctors and patients, payments to providers are reduced and delayed. Yet the old pay and chase is precisely the procedure that should be followed, with a well-proven twist. Insurers should not have carte blanche to require prior authorization for routine procedures or medications, but they should be able to reap substantial awards when they do uncover fraud. The nearly 160-year-old False Claims Act, also known as Lincoln's Law, assesses treble damages against fraudsters and gives incentives to whistleblowers to share in such recoveries. Significantly, this arrangement results in the federal government recovering more than $2.6 billion annually just from healthcare scams. Congress should extend the formula to all healthcare fraud, not just federally funded procedures. The current system of prior authorization harms too many patients, erodes the doctor-patient relationship, and uncovers too little fraud, while bolstering an insurer's bottom line. It's time to flip the model.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, next up, a good story providing an example of how our for-profit healthcare system is not particularly good at providing services that may produce a lot of health, but don't produce a lot of profit. This from Stat News. Fee or free? The services hospital-based psychologists provide are priceless. Hospital-based psychologists are sorely undervalued, not just for the care they provide their patients and the insights they offer their clinician colleagues, but for the substantial savings that they can provide their institutions. Under the current fee-for-service model in healthcare, a typical one-hour therapy session with a psychologist nets their hospital or institution about $150. not enough to hire a psychologist on even a modest salary, making it difficult, if not impossible, for healthcare systems to employ them. Yet the potential cost savings by increasing the number of psychologists in healthcare systems is undeniable. Take the example of Lauren Reinar, a colleague of mine who is an assistant professor in supportive oncology at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, and a specialist in health psychology, who recently treated a 74-year-old man with cancer and anxiety. Due to the long-term effects of his cancer, he had multiple complications, like heart problems, that required careful monitoring. He was so anxious about his condition that he called clinic nurses three or more times each week and scheduled duplicated or unnecessary checkup appointments with specialists for the same concerns. His anxiety about his medical status, while understandable, was taking nurses' time and chalking up unnecessary billed visits with physicians. Reinar initiated cognitive behavioral therapy, a form of therapy that has been demonstrated to be effective in health-related anxiety with the patient. Across 15 sessions, he was able to significantly reduce the number of calls and appointments, and the patient reported significantly reduced anxiety. Those 15 sessions with a psychologist likely resulted in a total bill cost to the patient and his insurance of about $2,250. Each hour of a nurse's salary costs about $43, and each session with a physician specialist costs about $500. A conservative estimate of the cost savings resulting from Reinar's services would be $4,300, well above her actual charges. Extrapolating the cost savings across a full year, investing $2,250 in psychological treatment saved the healthcare system more than $28,000. I recently treated a patient who had made inappropriate sexual comments and inappropriately touched nurses while in the ICU for a heart procedure. Several nurses requested to be transferred to other patients. The unit director and legal team were involved, and staff nurses said they didn't feel safe. When the patient was admitted to my unit, the acute rehabilitation floor, I spent 2.5 hours developing and writing a behavior plan and educating nurses and other staff to ensure they knew how to use behavioral techniques like assertive communication and repositioning to keep themselves safe. The result was dramatic. There were no instances of inappropriate sexual touching or comment during the patient's 7-day stay in the unit. There was one instance of inappropriate touching a nurse's arm and side, who immediately responded assertively to redirect the patient. The man's insurance wasn't billed for any of that time, earning the hospital no money. Yet sexual harassment or assault by hospitalized patients increases the risk of staff turnover, resulting in considerable psychological and economic costs. The average cost of hiring and onboarding a new nurse is more than $36,000, priceless compared to unbilled time as a psychologist and reduced threat to staff safety. Two British authors have argued that more mental health care would cost nothing when its impacts on physical health care spending and welfare benefit spending are accounted for. To be sure, the costs that psychology services prevent, like future health complications and trauma, aren't always realized directly by the hospitals or clinics that pay psychologists' salaries. Insurance companies, as well as hospitals, can benefit from psychology services in the form of improved patient and staff satisfaction, fewer medical complications, lower staff turnover, and improvement in the management of patients with chronic illnesses. These services may even dramatically reduce costs across the healthcare system, even once the cost of salaries and benefits are taken into account. With the current fee-for-service model, this goal isn't attainable. Switching to a value-based payment model that accounts for the total costs and benefits of a service's service, include the future cost savings, would make it possible. Until then, everyone pays the price. Okay, well, I'd like to do two more stories that get at how a public health approach, a more comprehensive approach to medicine, healthcare, rather than sick care, benefits us all. One is about nutrition and the other is about gun violence prevention. Let's start with the nutrition one. This is from Dr. David Katz. The cents and dollars of food as medicine. What would you call the following scenario? A nation of families spends a portion of their income on poor quality food that routinely makes them sick and kills them prematurely. Employers, insurance companies, and the government help most of them pay for the drugs and treatments necessary to treat the conditions caused in large measure by, quote, bad food. The cost of treatment for conditions hardly anyone needed to get in the first place routinely exceed the cost of the food largely responsible for engendering those conditions. Perhaps crazy comes to mind? Bizarre? Nuts? Outrageous? Absurd? Ridiculous? preposterous? I would call it just another day in America. Just another day in much of the modern world, for that matter. Because the substitution of disease-inducing junk where food ought to be is not only a substantially American invention, but a very lucrative export. We have done our utmost to sell the amalgam of food as an assault on public health and medicine as remedy to anyone remotely capable of buying it. There is a better way. In rebuttal to this massive outrage hiding in plain sight, an outrage that has made adult onset diabetes a quotidian diagnosis in our children, that is seemingly a quite bland statement, that almost any way would be better way, would be a better way, all but screams at us. But we are seemingly blind to the outrage and deaf to the screams. So perhaps a bland statement may better serve the urgency, just as a whisper is at times better at attracting attention than a yell. There is a better way. First, let's revisit my use of, quote, bad as a descriptor for food above. The case has often been propounded by ostensible authorities that there's no such thing. I beg to differ. Ultra-processed concoctions willfully engineered to be addictive are, in a word, bad. And let's take it further. Bad is as bad does. Whenever a given assembly of foods is salently implicated among the causes of chronic morbidity and or premature mortality, as the typical American diet most assuredly is, then it is bad. This is not a moral judgment. It is a verdict predicated on consequences. The flight path is in substantially slower motion, but this is bad in just the way that a bullet hole through the chest is bad. Bad outcomes of eating per routine in America prevail, and thus, ipso facto, bad food prevails. Food is not supposed to ravage organ systems, propagate degeneration of body parts, or accelerate our surrender to senescence. We will eventually succumb to these forces no matter how well we eat and live, but the blue zones show us how vibrantly and how long a well-nourished, well-tended body is apt to defend itself. There's nothing genetically special about blue zone populations. The, quote, blessings they enjoy, a greater bounty of years in life, a far greater bounty of life in years, unencumbered by the chronic disease they routinely avoid, are courtesy of lifestyle. In principle, a salutary diet and lifestyle is an option for all. In practice, however, this is not the case. The choices people make, whatever our level of personal responsibility and self-discipline, are subordinate to the choices people have. Aggressively peddle willfully addictive junk food and normalize the notion that chronic disease is a societal rite of passage, polypharmacy an inevitable consequence of reaching midlife, and the good choices people otherwise might make reside on the remote side of a bridge too far. The SNAP program, directed at nearly 1 in 7 American families struggling to put adequate food on the table, might be considered the highly visible tip of the same iceberg threatening to sink us all. I fully support SNAP as a partial remedy for a culture that cultivates massive socioeconomic disparities and preferentially markets obesity and chronic disease for profit to those who can least afford the toll. But a dispassionate appraisal shows how deranged the status quo is. We, the American taxpayers, spend tens of billions of dollars to subsidize SNAP and thereby help relatively poor people secure access to horribly poor food, and thus achieve dreadfully poor health. We then spend many more tens and hundreds of billions of dollars through Medicaid to treat that poor health, and all too often do it poorly. If you can spot the winner in this scenario, the golden jelly beans are all yours. We might, instead, provide easy-to-understand guidance to better quality foods, financial incentives to choose it, and nip this whole noxious bloom in the bud. We have cause to hope as well that there may indeed be a silver lining when the dark clouds of the COVID pandemic finally part, a bright light shining on the acute liabilities of chronic cardiometabolic ill health. Among the pandemic's lessons is this: there is an acute case for chronic vitality. Those opposed to delayed gratification, take note and take heart. The benefits of food as medicine, rather than as preamble to the need for medications, confer gratification right away, before turning into the gift that keeps on giving. The powers that be, big food, big pharma, may not like this, but it is merely an expression of a free market mantra, adapt or die. There's no reason food can't be both big and good, a and no reason why the assets of pharma cannot diversify to investment in the right kinds of farms, just as big energy must now diversify to green or suffer the fate of the obsolete. Whether ill or well, nearly everyone who can eats nearly every day. The cost of eating something are thus fixed costs. The costs of food to nurture rather than degrade health are limited accordingly to the cost difference between bad and good food. The incremental cost, already apt to be vastly less than the cost of ill health as usual, would decline further with time as our food supply shifted its emphasis to the production of good. We could, if so inclined, monetize a revolutionary transition from our current disease care system to a system of literal health care. We could more readily transition from the dual costs of medication to fix only partly all the part of us food keeps breaking. Food is the medicine long ago invoked by Hippocrates, could save lives, vitality, biodiversity, and a vast fortune into the bargain. The drumbeat tolls of necessity in the guise of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, cancer, dementia, climate change, and the acutely calamitous toll of COVID as well, we may, whenever so inclined, invoke the will to invent the better way. Okay, and lastly, a public health approach to the epidemic of gun violence from the Hill. Data on gun violence would save lives, just like it has for car crashes. In 2010, total U.S. traffic deaths fell to their lowest level since the 1950s, due in part to more motorists buying into buckling up and embracing safety innovations. Motor vehicle deaths have remained roughly steady since that time, despite more people driving. Over the same decades, however, firearm death rates have remained steady and now started to rise. Why? Let's start by unpacking what led to the decrease in traffic deaths. Spoiler alert, it wasn't a single magic bullet. Rather, it was a combination of approaches under the three E's of injury prevention: education, engineering, and enactment. Education includes teaching the public about safe driving, basic driving rules, don't drink and drive, the hashtag Just Drive campaign to end distracted driving, and about safe behaviors, like using appropriate car seats for kids. Remember the crash test dummies from the 1980s and television spots about using seatbelts? Traffic safety campaigns also involve community or cultural change, like the Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, a slogan that also began in the 1980s. Engineering means making a product or environment safer, and sometimes this approach can work well because it doesn't rely on changing behavior, which we know can be hard. For traffic safety, engineering advances over the past decades have had a major impact on crash fatality rates. Car occupants are far more likely to survive a crash now, thanks to innovations like airbags, invented in 1951, seat belts, and crumple zones, the parts of the car designed to absorb impact and crumple in a crash. Newer technologies like automatic braking systems and blind spot detection may even reduce the likelihood of a crash even happening. Engineering of the environment outside cars also helped reduce deaths through things like rumble strips, highway guardrails, traffic lights, introduced in 1930, and urban design to reduce motor vehicle and vehicle-pedestrian collisions. Social engineering has included development of alternative transportation options, like Uber and Lyft, that may reduce drunk driving. Enactment of laws was a third component to reducing traffic deaths. In 1970, the Highway Safety Act established the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, a national organization responsible for reducing deaths, injuries, and economic losses from motor vehicle crashes. This National Health Traffic Safety Administration oversees large educational campaigns as well as vehicle safety testing, ratings, and recalls. Federal and state laws set speed limits and policies around driver licensing and driving while impaired. A key component of enactment is enforcement. That is, how are laws actually implemented and enforced, such as through heightened patrolling for drunk driving during holiday periods. So what does all this mean for reducing firearm-related injuries and fatalities? Well, the first takeaway should be that there's not a single magic bullet here either. It's going to take a combination of approaches as well as the research to understand which ones work and why. We need educational efforts to reduce firearm injuries and deaths, things like campaigns about secure home firearm storage to keep guns out of the hands of kids, and reducing firearm access in times of suicide risk, and violence interruption programs with trusted community messengers. Maybe have a brave conversation will become the new Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, as we encourage friends and family to look out for those with suicide risk. and we need engineering approaches like biometric smart guns, which can only be fired by an authorized user, and storage devices like safes, quick access lockboxes, and trigger locks. Yes, we will also need enactment of policies if we want to significantly reduce firearm injuries and deaths in the United States. But we need thoughtful conversations about those policies, and then research to evaluate their effect on a range of outcomes, rather than knee-jerk reactions, either pro or con. Beyond the policies most often debated, we should also be thinking about policies to encourage secure home firearm storage, facilitate temporary firearm transfers in times of suicide risk, reduce liability for firearm outlets that offer temporary storage to prevent suicide, and even establish a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration-like entity for firearm injury. Enacting firearm-related legislation alone won't solve the problem of firearm-related injuries and deaths, nor will education, nor will engineering. We need them all, and we need the research to inform them all. We need to engage varied voices in these discussions. We need to move away from vilifying the other side and instead embrace the fact that all of us want to keep our friends and loved ones safe from harm. We've been down this road before. With a comprehensive approach to traffic safety and reducing motor vehicle deaths, we can do it again, this time with firearm injuries. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.